Item number four on the agenda is the Lahontan Water Board Cannabis Unit Update.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Eric Tatzer, and I am the senior of the cannabis unit for the Lahontan and the Colorado River regions. So, just want to take this opportunity before TJ gives his presentation, just to give a brief, just a few opening remarks. I started the position last October, and even before I started, the first thing I did was to hire TJ, which is probably the best thing that could happen. He comes with a strong engineering background. He has great experience in agricultural outreach. And he's been really instrumental in helping just resolve issues as they arrive. And let me tell you, with this program, it's every day is a new challenge. We come up with all sorts of different issues, and regulating a brand new industry, definitely comes with its lumps and bumps, but it's also really exciting and it's fun. And I think that's the key takeaway, is this has been a really fun project to work on. With that, I want to take a few moments to thank a few people. I'd like to thank Doug Cushman, who is the senior of our non-point source unit. He has been so kind to donate one of his staff, his scientific aide, Kathleen Doran. She's helped us out quite a bit, and a lot of the maps that you'll see in the presentation are a result of her hard efforts. I'd like to thank our Victorville staff for putting up with us and helping us as much as, whenever we ask for assistance, they've always been there to provide guidance and outreach as well. I'd like to thank the staff at Region 7 for helping us address all their region-specific issues. And also, want to kind of inform you, too, that we are sensitive to other units in our office. We are highly funded, and we do like to, I personally would like to look for opportunities where we can see projects that cross unit boundaries, where we can provide assistance to help out other units, and I have talked with Dan and other folks about that, so that's something that we are constantly looking at doing. So having said that, I won't waste any more time, and I'll bring TJ up here to talk about our cannabis program.
Thank you for that introduction, Eric. That was very nice. All right. Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is TJ Minowas-Clark, and I'm a water resources control engineer, as Eric said, in the cannabis unit based in South Lake Tahoe. So like I said, we're covering the extent from the Lahontan region and the Colorado River regions. And I'll be presenting the cannabis cultivation regulatory program update. So, let's get there. Very good. Okay. So starting out with outline-wise, we're looking at the regulatory framework, both the development and the implementation of that, and then also the regional implementation. So what we've done is the Eastern California Regional Cannabis Unit, and our program workload that we're identifying so far, the outreach, the permitting, the enforcement, and then also the program outlook, so the things we're seeing down the road that are coming up in terms of both the case study, looking at a specific instance of one of the counties here in the region, and then also some of the other next steps, the things that we're identifying. Is this better? All right, so in terms of state agencies that are involved in the cannabis process, on the licensing side, we have CDFA, and it's their Cal Cannabis program, and then the California Department of Public Health with their Manufactured Cannabis Safety Branch, and then the Bureau of Cannabis Control. Now, where they all align along this spectrum from cultivation, manufacturing, distribution, testing, and retail is that Cal Cannabis focuses on the cultivation component, and then my understanding is the California Department of Public Health covers the manufacturing, some of the distribution, and some of the testing, and then the Bureau of Cannabis Control also does testing and retail. But they also, when you have a small enough size business, they'll run the entire gambit from cultivation to the retail level. And so most of our interaction as the water boards is with Cal Cannabis or with the Bureau of Cannabis Control. And both of them, as far as I understand, are identifying the need for our permit in their licensing process. So part of the way that we get permittees or applicants coming to us to become permittees is through the licensing process. So in terms of the regulation development, let's skip that one. So there are several inputs that came in to develop the cannabis policy that the Water Board uses as a backbone for the program. Water Code, Office of Enforcement, Division of Water Quality, and Division of Water Rights all provided input into that and developed that document. And then from that was developed both the Cannabis General Order, which is waste discharge requirements and waiver of waste discharge requirements, both contained in a single document. And that was developed by Division of Water Quality along with using cannabis policy to draw from. And then Division of Water Rights worked on a small irrigation use registration program, expanding that to include cannabis usage. So the cannabis policy itself then informs all four of these areas. They inform the Office of Enforcement, it informs the Division of Water Quality, it informs the work of the Division of Water Rights, and also the work that we do at the Regional Water Boards. So then another implementation step is the Small Irrigation Use Registration Program. And we don't do very much with that directly ourselves, other than when we're out on inspection at a site, we're identifying whether or not they're complying. But most of that goes to the Division of Water Rights. And then similarly, the Office of Enforcement would also step in if someone was out of compliance. Next, we have the Cannabis General Order, and that's what we work with most of the time. So the Division of Water Quality and Regional Water Boards are both doing a lot of the heavy lifting here in terms of processing notices of applicability when applications come in and sending those back out to people who become permittees. And then the Offices of Enforcement also assist with during the inspection process someone is found to be out of compliance. So and then the actual breakdown of the general order in terms of people who fall under it or are exempted from it, there's the first level, which is the exempted cultivators. So these are people who is just a personal grow. It's either an indoor or outdoor location. It's a very small disturbance area, and there's no commercial activity associated with it. These individuals do not have to apply, and so there's no fee that's applicable to them. Excuse me. Let me change the slide first. I'll give you a second on that. And then there's the waived level. So these are particularly people who are indoor cultivators, and then also small outdoor cultivation sites under 2,000 square feet. Once they've applied, gone through the process, and received their notice of applicability from us, that expires on December 18th of 2022. And their fee for application is $600. It's a flat fee for all sites. So then the third level is the permanent facilities. These are also commercial facilities. They're outdoor. They're larger facilities. There is no set expiration date, but they are an annual renewal. So they have to meet annual requirements to stay within the program, including paying an annual fee. The way that they're tiered in terms of annual fee is based on a combination of tiering per size and then also risk factors. So you can see here there's low, moderate, and high. Slopes lower than 30%, outside of riparian setback, they're considered a lower risk facility. Once the slope gets below or above 30%, and they're still outside the riparian setback, a little bit higher risk, and then the highest risk is the inside the riparian setback. And in terms of tiering, we have a size that's 2,000 square feet to 1 acre, and then greater than or equal to 1 acre. And then the fee, of course, is associated with that. So this is the general application process to become enrolled in the permit. The applicant submits a digital application through a portal that is actually hosted by State Board. That processes the application, is then sent to us as an applicant summary in an email, and also a notice of receipt. It's also sent to the applicant in both the applicant summary and the notice of receipt. In the notice of receipt, they get their number to use to pay their fee. And then once they pay their fee, we are allowed to begin processing their application. And so we determine the completeness, we go through a review, and depending on whether or not they have a complete application, assuming they do, then we issue the notice of applicability. That goes back to the applicant, and then they submit the notice of applicability to Cal Cannabis. And as I was saying before, this is often triggered at the front end when they get to their licensing process with Cal Cannabis and realize that they need their environmental permits. So on a nice note, Cal Cannabis does some more outreach for us that way. So in terms of regional implementation. Now, most of the regions within the state of California are just operating within their own region. There are two units that have more than one region. We're one of them, as Eric pointed out. We do the Lahan and the Colorado River regions. Also, the South Coast Regional Cannabis Unit takes care of Los Angeles, Santa Ana, and San Diego regions. So there's some interesting challenges around that. One of them is, you know, as people stationed within Lahan, we're learning the regional rules, goings-on of Region 7, some of the administrative procedures, because when we issue NOAs, it goes through them, and also just the regulations that they have on a region-wide basis. And general challenges that we have as well, just because it is cannabis, it's relatively new to being regulated, are site safety concerns. So that's something that's being dealt with mostly through State Board at this point. But that's definitely a concern and something that we're trying to address. And then in terms of the staff that actually go out there, as Eric was pointing out, it's been he and I so far over the winter. And then Carly Nielsen is joining the unit. And we have three vacancies as of right now. In terms of timeline, from what I understand, Eric is currently reviewing the applications. He's planning to do interviews later this month, early next month in August, and possibly then extending offers in mid to late August, somewhere in there. So we should be fully staffed out hopefully by beginning of September, late August, somewhere in there. It's been very interesting having the staff, and it'll be really nice to expand out to the staff and be able to fulfill all the roles that we're hoping to do. So in terms of workload, the three main components so far have been outreach, permitting, and enforcement. So part of our outreach process is through a website. We had to build a website, get the message out to people, allow people who are coming to the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board's website to find some answers. And so I've actually put on this slide, there is both the website for the regional cannabis website and then also for the State Board website. And then in terms of events, too, so we've gone out and tried to meet these cultivators face-to-face. Before I even started, Eric started working on conference calls with different jurisdictions throughout the region. I believe you worked with City of California City, City of Lancaster, Cathedral City, City of Desert Hot Springs, so all those in Region 7, several of those in Region 7, and then Mono County here in the region as well. We also went to ordinance meetings where there were planning commissions, board of supervisors in various counties were looking at adopting ordinances, just acting as outreach or resource for the boards of supervisors or the planning commissions. We also went to Cal Cannabis licensing events, both one in West Sacramento and then one down in the Palm Desert, so we had presences both ends of the state, and a site visit down in Colville area from here. And recently did a presentation to the San Bernardino County Environmental Strike Force, which was a meeting that we did down there in conjunction, actually, with the Santa Ana Water Board Unit, the South Coast Regional Water Board Unit. We also, while we were down there as well, started to identify an issue with potential pushback on accepting wastewater by wastewater treatment plant operators in Region 7. And so while we were down there, we arranged a meeting with them to try to facilitate discussion between them and cultivators and try to figure out what issues they were running into in terms of accepting cultivation wastewater. So that's something that's very much in its infancy in terms of discussions at this point. So, in terms of applicant numbers so far, we have had, these ones were from June 28, 2018. I'm going to actually update you verbally with some new numbers. So far, in terms of application, total applications submitted, Region 6 has 28. Region 7 has 47. In terms of total fees paid, Region 6 has 15. Region 7 has 37. In terms of NOAs issued total, Region 6 has 13. Region 7 has 26. So these numbers have even changed in the last 2 weeks. Basically, we're seeing numbers change here and there, depending on people running out the clock on their temporary licenses from Cal Cannabis and realizing that they need to re-up and now they need an environmental permit for that. And then also, Cal Cannabis has been doing some email outreach for us, basically, too, by giving people a heads up, people who already have their temporary license, they also need to get their environmental permits in place. So in terms of applicant numbers, looking at this spatially, we haven't had nearly as many applicants in the north end as we have towards the south end. We started processing applications for Mono and Inyo counties just in June. And that also coincides with people started becoming interested because the local ordinances came through this spring as well for those. And it's been more of an outdoor focus as well in the northern area that we've seen. So in terms of applicant numbers in the south end of the unit area, we've seen it a lot in cities. And that corresponds with the cities are the ones that have actually had the local ordinances being in place. So it's sort of an interesting relationship there because these are cities, but they're also very large cities. They don't always have community sewer systems throughout the entire city. So you have a few places that that don't have wastewater treatment plant connections as they're putting in their projects. One thing that also actually is sort of an update, something that just came in very recently, is as of July 12th, we got an official letter from Palm Springs Wastewater Treatment Plant saying that they have a moratorium on accepting wastewater from cultivators there. And that may be something that might come from other wastewater treatment plant operators down there, and it's part of what I was mentioning about we're trying to work with them to see what we can do to help facilitate them being able to take that wastewater. So we also, in terms of numbers, what we've seen so far, we are anticipating more coming in, not just from what we've seen from Cal Cannabis, but also from discussions with like the Needles wastewater treatment plant operator. He was mentioning that he thinks there's something like 50 operators within Needles right now, 50 cultivators, and we've only seen a few come out of there. So we've also seen a fair amount of CEQA documents come out of Lancaster, from Adelanto and also California City, which suggests that we're going to be seeing more applicants out of those areas as well. So one of the concerns with these cities that are relatively rural areas and their inability to be connected to community sewers is that that means that these cultivators need something to do with their wastewater. And right now we don't have any sort of general order that they can just sign on to for or apply for any sort of on-site treatment system. So the issue would be looking at individual orders if they wanted to treat on-site. Otherwise, a lot of them, what they're doing right now is they're using a sealed tank and then hauling it off to a different location to do treatment. And so this is something we're looking at right now. And this is based on discussion that has occurred previously in terms of wastewater, looking at wastewater within the region. Right now, I've created a draft order. It's under internal review, and we're looking forward to, hopefully in the future, bringing it forward to the board as a workshop item. So in terms of local ordinances, what have we seen so far? What I've got on here is approved, banned, and pending locations. Towards the north end, we have Nevada County and South Lake Tahoe are both pending right now. We know there's an ordinance that's been looked at in South Lake Tahoe. But we've heard at our Region 5 friends, Nevada County, even though they're pending, they may actually be issuing permits, or permits under, I guess, a non-existent ordinance yet, to potential cultivators. And then Mono County and Inyo County both have something in place. And as I understand it, Mammoth Lakes has a medical ordinance in place. So then on our southern end, as was mentioned before, it's mostly cities. That's where you've seen the green approved, with the one exception of Imperial County down at the south end. And then also Riverside County is looking at issuing an ordinance. And they recently had a planning commission meeting on that back in June. Los Angeles County as well. It's sort of interesting with some of these sites, especially with not having an ordinance, countywide ordinance in place. You have unincorporated areas that are interested, though, in putting, you know, in building some sort of facility. Like we've heard word out of the Nipton is looking at building a large cannabis facility there, possibly with cultivation in it, but it's currently on an unincorporated location. And so whether or not the county goes through, will allow them or not. So. So then we move to program outlook. First, I'm going to start with a case study of Mono County and what, just using that as an example of what we could be seeing moving forward, and then also general next steps. So one of the things about an entire countywide ordinance is that oftentimes they'll limit them to specific land uses. And that's one of the things you can see in Mono County. You look here at the figure for this case study, and the gray areas are public land where it's just not allowed at all. Oftentimes this is federal land, and so, you know, it's not part of the regulated by the county in that manner. But then in terms of the private land, because of the way the land use designations work, you have these concentrations, particularly in these valleys, of where the cultivation could occur. So there's some concern for us in terms of concentrating these cultivations and what impact that could have in the long term on the environment. And one of the things about the public lands, though, is that even though we're going to be, you know, we'd be permitting sites in these very concentrated areas, we could still have the legal sites out in these gray areas where it's not allowed. And so we need to develop these partnerships with particularly federal agencies so that we can work with them on illegal sites. So the next step after identifying that is to do some risk assessment. Part of the work that's been done so far on that is to develop a cannabis identification and prioritization system, and that's mostly been piloted through Regions 1 and 5. Right now, 5 is mostly looking at permitted sites, and so they've developed the system. The shorthand for that is SIPS, and when a site is permitted, particularly an outdoor site, we outline the permitted area, and then it determines, based on 7 risk factors, essentially the quantified relative risk of that site. And then once you have enough sites within a watershed, it can quantify the relative risk of the entire watershed. And so Region 1 is piggybacking off of that and using the already delineated sites to train software to identify illegal sites based on what permanent sites look like. So we're trying to identify those, and that'll also factor into the risk in the watershed. So and then the next step from there, so that's what we kind of are already piloting. The next step would be to make that into a feedback loop. So take the actual water quality data we have and try to tie that back with what we're thinking is the risk in each watershed and try to figure out what that feedback, you know, figure out if we actually are quantifying the risk correctly and if we are prioritizing and have been concerned about the right watersheds based on what we're seeing from the permitting and the illegal operation side of things. And this is somewhere I think that we're hoping our resources could help other units as well. So in terms of next steps generally for the program, a big component of this, you know, these are typically operations, if they already were in existence, oftentimes they were illegal, they would have never been permitted or very lightly permitted in the past. So they're coming into the permanent fold. So a lot of our work is the permanent compliance standpoint right now. We're trying to outreach to people, make sure they're aware, trying to get them under the permit, that sort of thing. So some of the main ones on here are respond to cultivator questions. We get a lot of phone calls of how do I even get into the application portal? And facilitate discussions between local jurisdictions and cultivators. To consult with tribes regarding cultivation policy. And to assist with local jurisdictions with ordinances. So the next steps in terms of permitting, from that perspective, which, you know, once we've reached out to them, we want them to become permanent. So review and comment on environmental pre-project documents, process applications for the general order, assist publicly owned treatment works with pre-treatment program development, possibly. Part of that tying in with wastewater treatment plant operators and facilitating them. Review applications for domestic waste discharge consistent with water board policy. Provide feedback to state board on future policy updates. And develop water quality, data visualization, and feedback loops. And then finish draft proposed on-site wastewater treatment systems general order. And then in terms of enforcement, that's sort of our third tier of our workload, is to work on inspecting permitted sites, to identify illegal sites, and assist local investigations of illegal sites, and then also to conduct enforcement actions on permitted and illegal sites. All right, and that's all I have on my end.
Thank you. Can take questions from board members, beginning with Mr. Gaius.
Yes, thank you. One question. What is the primary objective of wastewater treatment plant operators to accepting wastewater from cannabis operations?
Sort of the unknowns. So the main concern down there is TDS levels. And they don't know when the TDS, the potentially high TDS wastewater from a cultivation facility may enter the wastewater system and then hit their treatment plant. A lot of those wastewater treatment plant operators down there haven't really worked with industrial facilities before. They're mostly domestic. You know, Palm Springs, Palm Desert, a lot of houses, not as much of the industry. And so this is a completely new stream for them. And they're worried about that slug coming through and just knocking out their entire system. Or they're so near their TDS level already, they're worried it'll just push them right over the edge.
Okay, thank you. No more questions.
Mr. Jardine.
Well, you just asked the question I was going to ask. My community deals with South Lake Tahoe PUD, so their wastewater does come into Alpine County and use for irrigation. Plus, we're potentially looking at tribal lands being used for commercial groves, and this concern came to us from tribal members, but we'll just keep an eye on it.
Yeah.
Mr. Sandell.
TDS, why would the waste from a cannabis operation have, except, I'm just thinking about it relative to, say, a farm, which it is, except farms don't usually go to sewage systems. Why would we have to worry? I guess the question is, in some cases when we're regulating something that's growing, we require application at agronomic rates so that there's nothing left over, in essence. Mm-hmm. Why aren't we looking at their process more closely? We should be perhaps not allowing TDS at all to get back into the sewage systems.
Right, so the actual permitted facilities that we directly permit are all outdoor facilities, and those ones we actually do require to have a nutrient management plan in place with us. But the indoor facilities fall under the waiver to the general order, and so they're discharged to the wastewater treatment plant. We don't actually regulate that directly.
If they're creating a condition of nuisance, why can't we regulate them?
Can I rely on you for that, Eric?
Eric Taxer again, senior with the cannabis unit. The issue with the TDS from the indoor cultivation sites, a lot of that comes from the reverse osmosis systems that a lot of them are using. They are recycling the water in the facility, and you know they are applying various nutrients and whatnot to their water stream to fertilize the crop, that in the process of filtering that out, they are also concentrating all the other salts in that process, and then they have that waste from the reverse osmosis process to discharge. Some of that, depending on the facility, it might be a solid waste that they're, or a sludge that they're going to be discharging, and that's something that they can haul off. Other times it is just a wastewater stream. Some of the facilities from Region 7 have reported TDS concentrations in their effluent of up to 2,000 parts per million.
Pretty high.
And the facilities down there are under, some of them are under temporary orders, ratcheting their TDS effluent to, I believe, 600 parts per million. And the Region 7 staff is looking at those wastewater treatment plants and considering even ratcheting that level down further to protect their groundwater resource. And they also have the salt and sea issue, too, that they're trying to deal with. So it's a very tricky situation in the Colorado River region. It's something that's rearing its head now. It's something that is has not been addressed statewide. This is the first time this has come up. And we're looking at it proactively to see how we're going to start addressing it within the Lahontan Water Board region as well. We see this as something that may potentially affect this region and other regions statewide. So, lucky for the Colorado River region, they're sort of the test case on this that we're all going to be following.
Okay. But are you saying that we do have the ability to regulate these if we have to, even though they're under waiver?
Yeah, we do. Rob, do you want to chime in on that one?
Yeah, Rob Tucker, Senior Water Resource Control Engineer. And I've done the regulatory work for wastewater. What we don't want to get into the habit, and we can regulate pretreatment requirements individually on facilities. One of the reasons most of us in the wastewater industry have been hesitant is, if we start permitting, we want our wastewater facilities to do pretreatment requirements, which means they can say no. The flip side is if there are violations and we're going out doing independent orders and the violations at the wastewater is also, they're going to blame back up to our order and we have to enforce on the independent discharger. So we want to see that agreement between someone receiving the wastewater and the actual discharger who has the order. We want that agreement in place instead of us. Because what I'm concerned with is we permit somebody and they are considered the cause of an effluent violation from the permitted wastewater facility. So that's why we really want to see that agreement between them two, those two. But we do have the ability to place waste discharge requirements on pretreatment standards if we wish.
This is no different from somebody who has, say, a large RO operation for some other reason. Food processes, or who knows, but just water purification would have the same issues in terms of high TDS side stream coming out and possibly going to the treatment plant.
Correct.
This is going to be like that.
Correct.
And so they can regulate any of these and probably should be.
We hope to, and that's most of our larger facilities do have a pretreatment. We want them to have a pretreatment program. TTSA has a pretreatment, Tahoe Truckee Sanitation Agency, even though it's not an MPDS program, has that pretreatment requirement. And we prefer to see that in place than us going out and starting to inspect and regulate discharges into their collection system.
Thanks for that answer. I had another question, which is not related to TDS, but related to this whole topic of risk assessment. I'm kind of curious as to why are we doing this? I mean, this is like if you had an almond orchard and it was on a steep slope, would you be assessing the risk, and what would the risk be for? What kind of risk are we exposed to? In the case of cannabis, what's the risk? It's all going to come avalanching down the hillside? Or what? I don't quite get that.
Yeah, a lot of the risk initially was developed in the North Coast region. They had a lot of issues within the watersheds of the illegal sites and the people who were developing the sites prior to being permitted. that they were just basically building dirt roads to access these remote sites in sensitive watershed areas. So they had a lot of sedimentation issues into their pristine water bodies and rivers, affecting the fishery habitat. They also had illegal water diversions that were drying up the rivers in some cases and affecting endangered species habitat in those areas. So the CIPS program, the Cannabis Identification Prioritization System, was developed initially to address that, but then once it was developed, it was expanded to look at how can we use this system to identify potential risks in other areas. So in the example that TJ provided in Mono County, we can be more proactive in assessing potential risk. As we see sites being developed within a watershed, we can look at the criteria that have been developed in the CIPS program, and we can weight that criteria differently to be more region-specific. So we may not have the anadromous fish habitat issues, but we may be more concerned about perhaps groundwater impacts. We may be more concerned about erosion from different types of hillsides, more granitic soils than topsoils. So we can modify that differently to say, to help us identify areas where we want to focus our enforcement efforts and our inspection efforts, to say we maybe want to look at this watershed in particular as opposed to another watershed.
This just seems really entirely the wrong direction to be looking at this. You know, looking at it from this perspective just seems like this risk involved because. This is a steep hillside. You know, why don't we just say, don't put it there? You know, I mean, it's not like you know, we assess that the risk is higher, therefore we're going to charge you more for your licensing. Mm-hmm. You know, but you're probably not going to ever charge them as much as it would take to recover from something that actually went wrong. And I don't even see why we're going there. Anyway, my opinion. That's all I have. Thank you.
Ms. Cox.
Thank you, Chair. Your last slide, the one before this, you talk about the identification of illegal sites and working with the local jurisdictions. This is an area that I have a tremendous amount of concern with, and I'll give you a case in point. On Monday, in my small community, the sheriff's enforcement unit was out. They shut down 5 illegal grows and confiscated almost 8,000 plants in an adjudicated groundwater basin where we highly protect our groundwater uses. And in conversations with the captain, these illegal grows are just proliferating throughout the high desert at a very, very fast rate. With the legalization of marijuana, it has incited more of these illegal operations because they can take their product to legitimate dispensaries, and the profit margin is much greater for the operator. You can't trace back the DNA on these plants to a legal operator. And I feel like this is such a huge battle for us to get our arms around as regulators and bringing these illegal operators, you know, into compliance with operating practices that do not harm our groundwater resources and our sensitive water bodies and sensitive habitat. How is your current interaction with the law enforcement agencies in the two regions that you're working now? Have you developed those relationships? Are those on the checklist to work on next, or where are you in that process?
I'm going to give you a quick answer and then hand it off to Eric. So my understanding so far is, you know, we've done events like down in San Bernardino with their Environmental Crimes Task Force. Eric's had phone calls with sheriffs throughout the region, at least within our region, if not also Colorado River region. We've also been talking with some of the water districts, too, because they're running into issues where they're noticing that their water's tainted or their water supply drops strangely, you know, if they're using spring water, something like that, that they know should be pure, and then they're noticing constituents in that that shouldn't be there without human activity. And so we're not necessarily just working with law enforcement, but also with other local agencies that depend on that clean water, I'm sure. But I'll hand it off to Eric for more.
Yeah, the focus of the program is on permitting and to get the eligible entities enrolled in the permit, those who have the potential to be cultivating legally. With respect to the illegal cultivation, that's a huge, huge issue, and we recognize that's a huge issue. As TJ mentioned, we have made outreach efforts for we have made outreach to local law enforcement in different areas, as have our friends in Sacramento. But the primary focus right now is for us to focus on the getting the folks registered and enrolled in the program who can be, recognizing that that enforcement arm is something that needs to be done down the road. So I know it leaves concerns unaddressed still, but and we see it. We know that there are hundreds, if not potentially thousands, out there in throughout regions 6 and 7.
Well, in a perfect world, I've been fascinated seeing how quickly we as a region have come up to speed on this issue, and you and your staff in particular. But in a perfect world, what do you think the answer is? How can we get our arms around this issue that is just mushrooming?
That requires a lot of cooperative effort between us and law enforcement, and requires a lot of additional staffing, not only from us, but a lot of law enforcement staff. It's not an easy issue, and it's a very expensive issue to address. But it's something that I personally feel does need to be addressed, because in developing this program, how do you develop a level playing field so that the people who are complying with the regulations aren't penalized by being forced to comply with the regulations? You know, we want to, like any other industry, we want to ensure a level playing field for everybody. This is just a program that's has more challenges than other programs, because you don't necessarily have thousands of people operating illegal wastewater treatment plants, for example.
Right.
It's a different beast, and also has the safety issues. For example, when we go out to a site, we will be deconflicting the sites prior to going out there. We'll be working with the California National Guard to do that deconfliction for us. That MOU with the National Guard just got signed today, actually. So, and then we will be going out with law enforcement on some sites. We have been requested by our State Board staff to go out with either Fish and Game Wardens or with National Guard on any site, regardless if they are enrolled in the program or not, just to ensure sites staff safety. That is our primary concern. And it's not necessarily that we're concerned about issues with the cultivators. You know, these are people who are wanting to become involved. They want to come into the light. But there may be safety issues with neighbors who don't want this business in their backyard. So there's all sorts of considerations that come into play when it comes time to addressing this overall issue of working with illegal dischargers, too.
Thank you for your efforts in this area. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I don't have any questions. I find the word deconflicted to be a fascinating word. I've never seen it before. But I think in some ways it sort of sums up what we're dealing with here. We have to invent a word to talk about how we don't understand how to make this program work. Before we get to board comments, I don't have any cards, but is there anyone from the audience who wishes to speak to this agenda item to the board at this time? Seeing none, I'll ask for any additional comments from Mr. Diaz.
Only one. I'd like to agree with Board Member Sandell that a lot of the issues that we are facing in cannabis growing are similar to the other issues we face in agriculture and sometimes industry. And it's difficult to decide whether or not it requires a special consideration or whether we have existing policies that can deal with.
Mr. Jardine.
I have to agree with Kimberly that we've had grows discovered during firefighting efforts in the national forests of 15,000 or more plants, and there is a definite environmental impact on wildlife and groundwater. And I do indeed have a concern of pharmaceuticals an emerging concern. I've seen one report already on that, so I'm just a little concerned about treatment plans. That's it.
Mr. Sandell?
Nothing further, thank you.
Ms. Cox?
Nothing more.
In a previous life, I did enforcement on many of these sites when the commodity was illegal. And I thought that that was a nightmare of a process. It would not have occurred to me that when the commodity stopped being illegal, the process would not become any simpler, and in fact, in many ways, would become even more difficult than it was when it was strictly not legal. I think one of the problems here is that you have a legal commodity or a legal business, but it's rife with illegal business people, and I understand the idea of leveling the playing field for the people who want to comply, but it's just a huge difficulty, or it's a hugely difficult task to take something that was illegal per se and turn it into some kind of legal regulated business form. I have many concerns about this. The 17-year-old me would have thought that this was a really terrific deal, and what a good idea to usher in this new era. The present me has a lot of misgivings about this. Certainly the idea that legalizing marijuana was going to make was going to remove the possibility and the incentive and the context in which illegal activities were going to take place, the idea that that would happen was incredibly naive. But I think that one of the problems is that people are trying to devise mechanisms for this industry that's predicated on that kind of naive view of how this is all going to work out, and that there's no longer incentives for people to act illegally within this context. And I'm not sure that makes any sense. I don't think it comports with reality. But I think that's the hardest part of getting to Mr. Sandell's point, where you just say, look, this is an agricultural industry, and therefore we can use, and I think it's a really good idea to find ways that we can use existing templates and approaches to bring them to bear to this issue. But I think we have to really come to grips with, and I don't mean we in this room or we in this region, I really am looking over the hill, need to come to grips with the notion that this is just not a situation where you're coming up with a regulatory scheme for an otherwise business model that exists for all other businesses that are similarly situated. This has happened really fast. I wish we could have an agenda item where I didn't end up saying my heart goes out to the staff because this is so bloody difficult to have to deal with. And I'm glad to see that there are a lot of safety factors built in for our staff people because fooling around with these sites and fooling around with a lot of these people, and including neighbors, it is a dangerous thing. It's a legitimately dangerous thing, and would rip my heart out if something happened to one of our staff members because they were trying to implement this particular program. Please be safe, all of you who whose fingerprints are on this program, I hope that you're constantly communicating the difficulties that are presented by this to the people in Sacramento so that they can take a look at this scheme and maybe take a look at some ways in which it could be modified or made more rational, because it doesn't seem to me that there's a lot of rationality built into this on the part of the people who think they're going to get rich as growers, on the part of the people who think every grower is going to be a legal growing opportunity or a practitioner, and on down the line. I think there's still a tremendous amount to be learned about this, I'm sorry you have to be the guinea pigs that help us learn that. So if there's nothing else on this item, I believe that we're finished for the evening. We will reconvene here tomorrow at 8:30. Is that correct? Thank you all for being here. And thank you for all your good and hard work.